Tonight on Arena, we talk to Tony Mumrell about Quincy Jones and the art of soul singing, and we talk to Anne Crilly of the groundbreaking Derry Film and Video Workshop. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rt.ie/arena. Tony Mumrell is one of the most exciting soul and R&B singers, songwriters in Britain today. He has toured with some of the greatest artists in the world, including Whitney Houston, Earth, Wind and Fire, Celine Dion, Gary Barlow, Andrea Bocelli and Gwen Stefani. Tony was also a lead vocalist with the acid jazz band Incognito for 16 years before launching his solo career in 2015. This April the 18th, Irish audiences will have a chance to hear Tony sing at the National Concert Hall with the RTE Concert Orchestra at an evening to celebrate the music of Quincy Jones. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Tony Mumrell. Tony, as I said, you're a soul singer, a songwriter, solo artist and lead singer. And in the National Concert Hall, you'll be interpreting the songs of Quincy Jones. What has Quincy Jones' music meant for you as an artist?
Hi there. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You're so welcome.
Yeah. You know what, Quincy's amazing. I mean, if we really look at the amount of body of work that he's done, he's influenced so many genres of music as well as different generations. And so for me, growing up as a kid, I discovered Quincy through the music of Stevie Wonder and Diana Ross and his movie, his take on The Wiz, The Wizard of Oz. And I was mesmerized by the production. And obviously, being an artist myself, I discovered a little bit more about him in terms of the things that he did and the orchestrations. And he's amazing. He's a massive icon to me and as well as many other people.
So one of the artists whose song you will be performing, which was arranged by Quincy Jones, is Nat King Cole. And here is Straighten Up and Fly Right with Nat King Cole. That's Straighten Up and Fly Right, a song there by Nat King Cole, and it was written by Nat King Cole and Irving Mills. That is such a strange song, Tony. Can you give us some insight into it?
Do you know what? I'm still trying to figure that out myself. I've sung that song now a few times with the orchestra and as well as a big band, and I don't actually understand the actual storytelling of it in terms of what the song's actually about. I don't know myself.
Yeah, there's an awful lot going on in it. What is it about that Nat King Cole, that relaxed, wonderful delivery he has of music? Was he somebody that you listened to and that you modelled how you performed on?
No, I'll be honest with you. I mean, Nat King Cole, vocally, I think I was attracted to his tone and the way that he would deliver a story, you know, in terms of his vocal ability. It was so relaxed and so soothing. It's a characteristic that I like to adapt within what I sing. But Nat King Cole in general, I think that his particular style as an artist was very slick and very smooth. And you know what we do with the big band and the orchestra is a modernized version of that, but still retaining the classic parts.
Now, one of the greats that you are associated with is Stevie Wonder. I think, was it Paul Morley called you a 21st century Stevie Wonder? And you've recorded Golden Lady with Real People. You have had many interactions with Stevie Wonder.
Yes, that's you know, it's funny when. You know, as a young artist, when I started singing, you know, I was always influenced by so many different artists and thought, wow, I'd love to be like this. And I never did I imagine in my wildest dreams that I'd ever be able to be in a situation to meet these people. And some of them are now my friends. So, yeah, I've met Stevie, and it's an honour to be able to record some of the music that's influenced my career. And he's a genius.
And he really liked your version of Golden Lady.
Yes, he did actually. Yeah, I got a message. In fact, he gave me a phone call to say that he really loved the version and it was probably one of his favourite versions, which was, you know, quite mind blowing at the time.
Let's listen to Golden Lady with Tony singing.
Sure.
Don't Tony Mumrell there performing Golden Lady, a song by Stevie Wonder. Tony, you are working with Guy Barker, who will be conducting the Quincy Jones tribute show in the National Concert Hall. What kind of discussions have you around interpretation and working with an orchestra before? Because you have worked on the Quincy Jones repertoire with them before.
Yeah, I think, you know, the very first time I worked with Guy, who again is another genius, it was around, I think, 2016, and I was playing at the Cheltenham Jazz Festival with him. So that was with the BBC Concert Orchestra. And one of the things that he really made clear to me was he wanted me to sing it my way, my interpretation. And, you know, obviously there's certain cues that we still got to follow in terms of the arrangement, but he wanted to make me feel relaxed and how I would interpret it now. And that was a beautiful thing because it gave me that freedom. But at the same time, some of the melodies and some of the songs are so beautiful. I don't really want to stray too far away from what I've heard and what I've learned from the originals.
So when it comes to Michael Jackson, and you're going to be performing two of Michael Jackson's songs, She's Out of My Life from Off the Wall, and then from Thriller, you're singing the title track.
Yes.
So yes. How do you approach Mr. Jackson?
Oh, well, I can't do some of the things Michael did, but again, it's just me literally taking that song and interpreting it vocally the way that I hear it. And also because the original record doesn't have a full, you know, massive orchestra on it. So, and when you've got so much musical instruments around you, it does actually change the way you slightly sing. So it's a beautiful thing. It's just another way that we've taken the original and reformed it in another structure, and I'm just trying to complement it the best that I can. And I must say, the way that it's going to be on the 18th, it's going to be incredible. We're really going to have a great time.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to the original. Thriller there, produced by Quincy Jones and sung by Michael Jackson, and one of the songs Tony Mumrell will perform on April the 18th with the at the National Concert Hall with the Concert Orchestra when they do the music of Quincy Jones. As I said, you are a singer-songwriter and a recording artist yourself, Tony, and you've two critically acclaimed albums, Keep Pushing and The Best Is Yet to Come. Can we expect more solo albums from you?
Yes, actually, I'm currently writing a new album as we are now, and I'm looking to release a single of some sort coming towards the end of summer this year, with the view of releasing an album towards the end of the year.
And is this a good, you know, is it good to be on tour doing other people's material? Do you get time then to work on your own stuff?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I get re-energized because now my mind is focused on this completely different sphere of music, where now I'm transported on the stage with a massive orchestra and it's a different sound. But what that does is it recharges me. So when I go back into the studio to write, it just gives me some ideas as well as some more inspiration of where I want to go with this record that I'm creating at the moment.
Well, Tony, we're looking forward to hearing you at the National Concert Hall celebrating the music of Quincy Jones, but we'll end with listening to you singing Rising Up. And that was Rising Up, sung there by Tony Mumrell. And Tony will be appearing with the RTÉ Concert Orchestra at a night to celebrate the music of Quincy Jones on April the 18th at the National Concert Hall under the conductor-arranger Guy Barker. For further details, go to rte.ie/co. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. Last week, I dropped into the Irish Museum of Modern Art to visit an exhibition called We Realise the Power of It. It tells the story of the radical film collective Derry Film and Video Workshop. It was a woman-led film production company set up in Derry in 1983. Most of its members had little or no experience of making films, but they came together with a sense of urgency to make films addressing overlapping political tensions around issues like gender, class and, of course, the national question. Subjects like the Armagh women's protests, strip searching and security force surveillance were all topics touched on, all during a period of increased state censorship. The exhibition is curated by Sarah Grevu with the artist Kira Phillips. I met Sarah and Kira in Emma and also the Derry filmmaker Anne Crilly, who was a key member of the Derry Film and Video Workshop and just fell into filmmaking. You will hear clips from Anne's film Mother Ireland, which features journalist Nell McCafferty, politician and activist Bernadette Devlin McCalski, and Republican Mairead Farrell. But here Anne Crilly explains how it all began.
I was in the right place at the right time and I took a risk. And the right place was Derry. The right time was the early 90s when Channel 4 was setting up. And part of Channel 4's policy was to film different video workshops, like black workshops, women workshops, and they were looking to fund two in the north. I had just finished my MA in Anglo-Irish Literature at UCD and was literally just back in Derry, and some of my friends who were journalists told me that people were looking to set up a video group. I met people like Tricia Ziff then, and they said, would you be interested in going over to Channel 4 and talking about an idea for the project? I said, well, funnily enough, I have an idea that I didn't do for my postgrad research, but I'm interested in it, about representations of women in Irish nationalism, Mother Ireland.
Are you in lolly duty?
Nobody will ever, and that's just my basic philosophy in life, nobody will ever have anything unless they get up and organise themselves to fight for it and, if necessary, take it.
In fond devotion.
Mother Ireland was completed in March 1988. I was over in London doing the online edit, and about a few days later, I think on the 6th of March 88, one of the women interviewed, Mairead Farrell from Belfast, was shot dead by the SAS in Gibraltar. She had been claimed as being on IRA active service. Now, Mairead Farrell hadn't long been out of prison. She had served 10 and a half years, and actually there is a clip in this exhibition just after she was released when we updated the strip search tape to bring to Strasbourg. And I was so impressed with her vitality that I knew I want to interview her for Mother Ireland. But even to interview her for Mother Ireland, we had to clear it with Channel 4 because she had served a prison sentence as an IRA member. And they said yes, as long as she's not involved in anything now. And as far as we knew, she wasn't, so we interviewed her.
People on the outside, in general, society, looked at us as the girls in Armagh, and we shouldn't really be in there. We should be out here and let the men do it, you know. The men are quite capable of doing it, and they don't need women to do it. Women aren't supposed to be politically active. We're supposed to be looked after, taken care of, and definitely not participating in an Awash protest, never mind being in prison.
After she was shot, it was a very shocking incident, and then at the funeral in Belfast, there was people killed at the funeral by Michael Stone, and it set off a whole chain of events. We wonder, does Channel 4 not realise this? And they hadn't realised that the Mairead Farrell of Mother Ireland was the Mairead Farrell who was shot in Gibraltar. So on one hand, they cynically thought, oh, we have this footage of her that no one else has. And then on the other hand, because it was Thatcher's Britain, they were panicking, and there was a lot of attacks and threats of Channel 4 being privatised. Mother Ireland was made entirely within the broadcasting restrictions at the time. There was no reason not to screen it on British television until a reason came in, and that was October 88, when the 19th of October 88, when Douglas Hurd brought in broadcasting restrictions for Britain. And in the morning, everyone in Mother Ireland could have been on British television by tea time. If you took a very strict reading, half the women would have been off television, and including archive footage and a Christy Moore song.
Soldiers kicked down the door, called her a whore, while he lingered in Castlereagh.
had to go over to Channel 4. Channel 4 had a banned season, and they said they would screen Mother Ireland with some changes. And reluctantly, we agreed. So I went over to Channel 4 and sat with their director of programmes, Liz Forgan, in the editing office, negotiating, taking out some footage, putting in other footage, taking out the Christy Moore song. We had an actress in who recorded different voices for dubbing. And the only thing I wanted to keep was Mairead Farrell. And we did record versions with an actress doing her voice. And the version that was broadcast had an actress doing most of Mairead Farrell's voice, apart from when she was talking about the Mother Ireland image, but when she was talking about growing up in Belfast or being in prison, that was an actress's voice. And then when it was broadcast, people said, what was all the fuss over that about? Because the first half of the programme is historical, gives the background to the Mother Ireland image in Irish culture. And the second part of the programme is a discussion about feminism and republicanism, and some of that's some women might find very provocative or not agree with, but it was a discussion for me. I always introduced Mother Ireland as a subjective programme about what I felt as a young woman in my 20s in Derry.
The whole Rosaline or Mother Ireland image is a very difficult one to maintain. For example, once the Free State, 26 counties, got their independence, they said they had achieved victory and there's no need anymore to mention Rosaline sighing, moaning and weeping. And indeed, to refer to her at all would be to remind themselves that, in fact, the job wasn't finished yet, that part of the country was still occupied by British troops. So they very quickly stopped all references to Rosaline as such.
So the first film we see here is extracts from the Strip Search film. Sarah and Kira have blown-ups of stills from the film, which are very powerful.
At that time, in 1984, strip searching was a big issue in Ireland, in Armagh prison, but it was also a very divisive movement in the women's movement in Ireland. And our equipment had just arrived in Derry, and Jamie Dunbar, a film student, had come over to train us. And I had decided, as I say, I didn't want to film trees. I wanted to do something straight away and learn that way. So I decided that I would make a film about the strip searching in Armagh prison. Armagh prison was the prison for women in the north. In the early 80s, they introduced a policy suddenly that every time a woman entered and left the prison, she had to be strip searched. But most of the prisoners in Armagh were on remand, which meant they had to leave the prison and go to court every week. So even though they were taken in prison vans with guards, they had to be strip searched. When they left, went into court and came back to the prison, they had to be strip searched again. And if they resisted, they were forcibly strip searched. So it was a really emotional issue. And it was very divisive in the women's movement, because some of the Irish feminists didn't want to support the strip search campaign in case it would be seen that they would be supporting the Republican women and what they were in for. Other feminists like myself and Margot and Derry, we would say, well, that was state violence against women. How can you not support that campaign? But it was a very, very divisive issue.
You were saying, Sarah, when you were showing it to me, about how sensual the stills are. They're showing one thing, but expressing something very different.
The issue of strip searching was such an incredibly emotive one, and so, as Anne says, divisive, but also, I guess it anticipates a kind of an intersectional approach to feminism that feels quite familiar to us today. And the material around it, we were looking through this material and we were thinking about it, and it remains politically sensitive, and we wanted to be sensitive about how we worked with this material. You're looking at these materials, you're thinking about how you can share them, how you can display them, but you want to be true to the spirit of the materials, and you don't want to like aestheticize or make something beautiful that's actually a dark story. So we're looking at leaflets, we're looking at images of demonstrations, we're looking at ways that people were trying to share ideas about this very emotive issue. And when we came across in the archives this incredible roll of film that the collective had shot of a reenacted strip search, we were very excited to see them because they're incredibly beautiful photographs as well as being telling a story that the collective was trying to tell. So they produced these images as part of the promotional material around the film, and we have two very large versions of them on the walls as you enter the exhibition. And they're quite ambiguous images in a way. They're very beautiful, they're quite sensual, but they're also telling a story of a very brutal practice that was happening at that time. And I think we quite liked that ambiguity or that way. It's like a beautiful image that pulls people into the story of this exhibition.
Could you bring us back to that? I mean, it's very modern now in documentary making to have reenactments. Did that come naturally to you, or were you just searching for a way to tell a story?
I was searching for a way to illustrate it. It would have been very traumatic to ask any of the women involved to go through that process again. But I think the woman who was actually had her hair and shoulders being searched, that was a former prisoner. I was trying to get some sort of visual representation. The testimonies were very powerful, but something just a bit more to try and get across that horror.
Obviously, strip searching is something that happens behind closed doors. It happens inside of a prison. There's no way to film that. So the first attempt that was made by the collective was that one of the members, Margot Harkin, made a series of drawings that show the kind of brutality. And then the second attempt was with this set of photographs.
When did you decide, or how did you find out about this Derry Video Collective?
At the time, I was working in the CCA in Derry, the Centre for Contemporary Art, and we took a touring program in of films from the BFI and Lux in Britain that were called, it was called Film and Video After Punk, and it was a series of films from the same, around the same time, the 1980s and into the maybe early 90s. And I was looking at all these films and I was saying, this doesn't like sit very well with what I know was happening in Derry at the time or in the North at the time. And I was like, I wonder why that is. And I knew that there had been a group called Derry Film and Video Workshop. I knew some of the former members. And it made me interested in starting to delve into this history that didn't seem to be represented or historicized very well. So the first thing was that I invited Anne and Margot to speak as part of this screening series. And then when they came in, we started to think about how we might work with this material, gather the material together to begin with, because it was an archive of material, but not an archive in any formal sense. It was just, there were tapes that were in boxes. Some of them we knew where they were, some of them we didn't, so they had to be gathered. There was a paper archive of materials, which was full of incredible, incredible like texture and story. But all of those things needed to be found and pulled together. So we brought all that material together. I knew that I wanted to work with an artist around how this material could be made into an exhibition, how it could be shown and shared and edited to make something that made sense, to tell a kind of a story. So I approached the artist Kira Phillips.
And Kira, you must have been thrilled when you saw the archive and what you had to work with.
I suppose we've all seen a number of archival exhibitions. Very often when you go into them, they're quite dense in terms of textual material, and there's a lot that you are invited as an audience member to engage with. So I think a really important thing was just thinking about how we present in a way that can bring in a lot of different kinds of publics. So somebody who may know nothing about it, there is a lot for you to dig into as somebody who comes into the show. So you see, in some instances, you see Sarah's hand on the scanner holding a booking form. You see Margot's hand holding this RUC docket. And there's a kind of relationship between the hands, Margot's hands running through the hair in the stop strip searching images, and then Margot's hand again holding something that is a record of the group's activity or the things that they were subjected to in terms of police searches.
I've travelled quite a lot, especially with Mother Ireland, but what really fascinated and blew me away when I came into this exhibition was the whole context, because when you're in the context working, you're not analysing it. And I go, oh my God, yes. Oh, yeah, did we really do that? Were we really that cheeky in the letters to Channel 4? But it's what they, Sarah and Kira, saw, and that was really fascinating. We were too close to it. Looking at the way people worked at a certain time, and I'm sure it would be the same for some of the other workshops that Channel 4 funded. We felt an affinity, especially with the work of the Black Workshop, Sankofa, and Black Audio Collectives. But sometimes you just have to be so many years out of it or whatever and have fresh eyes, look at the material, see how they see it as important. It makes me rethink some of the material, and it also makes me think, God, weren't we great doing that?
Anne Crilly ending that report from We Realise the Power of It, currently on view at Emma. More information from emma.ie. It's Friday evening, so it's time to take a listen to the latest album releases. Ohio Players is the 12th studio album by American rock duo The Black Keys. It sees Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney expand their blues rock sound with the aid of A-lister friends Noel Gallagher, Greg Kurstin and Beck. New York rock band Vampire Weekend return with their fifth studio album, Only God Was Above Us, described as a journey from cynicism to optimism by lead singer Erza Koenig. And A La Sala, translated as To The Room, is the fourth studio album by American musical trio Krungeben, who are known for blending global music influences such as classic soul, rock and psychedelia. I'm joined now by John Marr and Sinead Nivorda, who have been listening to all three albums, and we'll start with The Black Keys, and this is Candy and Her Friends. That was The Black Keys and Candy and Her Friends, and I'm joined by Sinead Nivorda and John Marr. John, remind us about The Black Keys and their background. Dan Auerbach and Patrick Carney, they were childhood friends.
They are childhood friends from Akron, Ohio, a city synonymous with rock music. Auerbach, guitar, vocals, Carney, drummer, very much into Delta blues, garage rock, primal kind of rock. And they've been prolific. I mean, their first album was released in 2002. This is album number 12, so effectively an album every other year. And remarkably enough, they've managed to keep the standard high. They've done that because of they've used choice collaborators, and certainly this album features many other players. And it's a fine piece of work too.
Sinead, so as John says, despite having released 12 albums, they can, you know, either pick up the phone to collaborators, and they also do other things to keep themselves fresh,
yeah,
as in DJing.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, the fact it's an impressive 20 years, and you're right, this is quite an album of bangers, really. And it is a tough feat to accomplish in this day and age. But they still find new inspiration through reaching out to their friends, their collaborators, such as Dan the Automator Nakamura, Greg Kurstin, who himself has picked up 9 Grammys. He's worked with the likes of Sia, U2, Paul McCartney. But they also have been DJing at various parties and what they call record hangs from different basements and parties worldwide, just breaking out their 45s. So that DNA and party feel really rubbed off on them.
Tell us more about these parties. John's just back from LA. He was probably there as one.
I am bloody jealous. I can't say I've ever actually personally been there myself. But basically, they've gone on tour with these small underground basement parties where they bring their box of 45s. And just with the spirit and the DNA that they get from that feeling, I guess, it rubbed off on them. So they decided to let go a little bit, you know, in that they did say that this was one of the hardest records they've ever worked on, and it's the one that took the longest to make. But yet there was this injection of fun and that free spirit from the DNA of the parties that lended itself to this record. So, and that was their mission, really, to create something that was fun, and they've achieved that for sure. I mean, it's even hard to pick any highlights because it's an album full of bangers.
And you needn't share anything about the LA DJing or the parties you were at, John. But tell us a little bit about the collaborators they've worked with that they can pick up the phone to. Beck, Noel Gallagher, any surprises there?
Well, Beck is, I mean, I'm always excited whenever he appears, you know, a remarkable talent. And he's worked on about 7 of the tracks here, so roughly half the track listing. Over the years, they've worked with some really interesting people, Danger Mouse most specifically, and he helped imbue them with remarkable production and this album. And he's not involved here, but they have remembered all of that, and this is a crystal clear album. I mean, Sinead mentioned something interesting about this band, which is, you know, they've got these, they're a significant outfit, you know, globally famous, and yet have managed to retain that kind of outsider feel, you know, when you talk about these parties and these kind of DJ aspects. I mean, they're the kind of band that can play the Three Arena and yet feel like they're kicking against the establishment. And even though this particular album is exceptionally well produced and beautifully played, it still feels like something of a kind of an underdog's record, which is a remarkable confidence trick in a way.
I think you both picked out Paper Crown. Did you pick that one out as well, Sinead? We're going to listen to it now, but maybe talk us into it, because Beck and Juicy J are featured on that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great example of how a lot of musicians are evoking that utopian peak of the alt-rock hip-hop crossover. And when initially listening to it, I was like, this is very much like Beck. This reminds me of his amazing track, Wow. And it goes to show that they have a really strong collaboration. They've been writing together for a long time. And you know, as he said earlier, they picked up the phone and got back onto him. But this is an absolute standout. Whilst there are so many impressive absolute potential singles, this is one that stands out in that it is different, but it is, yeah, it's a genius track with Beck and also with Memphis hip hop legend Juicy J of 3-6 Mafia. So it's a great example.
Great, let's listen to it. Yes, so that's Paper Crown from Ohio Players by the Black Keys. So overall, Sinead, what did you think, and stars out of 5?
Stars out of 5. Well, it's definitely a song I'll be playing in my DJ sets, I reckon. Yeah, you know, as I said before, you know, they're not quite reinventing the wheel as such, you know. But their blend of soul-infused rock and roll serves up that perfect slice of addictive, feel-good, sing-along pop rock, complete with backing singers, groovy bass, a touch of the spring reverb in that rhythm and weep. I love a bit of surf rock, can't deny a bit of that. So I think overall it's a really impressive record for a band that's been together as long as they have been. And, you know, as John was saying, the fact they can go along to Three Arena and just kick back as if you could be in a basement. So 4.5 out of 5.
Oh, 4.5 out of 5. Very good. And from you, John?
It's a very solid 4 for me. I think this is a really interesting album. There's also a fantastic cover of the William Bell and Booker T. Jones song, I Forgot to Be Your Lover. It's just smart and clever, and the collaborations work a treat.
Now, the next one is Only God Was Above Us, and this is from Vampire Weekend. And as I said when I was introducing it, John, it's their first album in 5 years, but I think you would say it's not really their first, it's their first proper album maybe since 2013.
Yeah, exactly, because the last one, Father the Bride, was essentially an Ezra Koenig solo album called Vampire Weekend. And he is very much the beating heart of the band, but nonetheless, you kind of that previous album, you kind of missed the other players, and two of them are back now for this one, and it kind of roots the band kind of where they started in the late 2000s with a huge range of world music influences vying for attention. In lesser hands, all those different influences would sound like such a mess. You know, they throw the kitchen sink at this, but these guys are smart. You know, Koenig is a really gifted musician. Mm. I really like Vampire Weekend. I kind of was disappointed the last time around, but this has completely restored my faith. It kind of reminds me of Modern Vampires of the City, which is the last full Vampire Weekend album from 2013, a great underrated album. And this one, very much about New York, their home. The last one was kind of about LA, but this is a very interesting album.
Sinead?
Yep, absolutely agree. And they have been based in LA for some time. So it is lovely to hear a bit of New York in terms of the phrases, in terms of bringing that jazz influence back into it. Of course, New York is famous for the incredible clubs like Blue Note and Birdland. So it's lovely to have that represented. I think it's the most musically adventurous one since their 2008 self title debut, and they describe this one themselves as their magnum opus, but it's got so much there. The kitchen sink is definitely thrown at it, but it is so clever. You've got, with the experimentation, the jazz influence, the studio noodlings, you've got a bit of the Indian classical music tradition, raga. So Ezra Koenig had actually taken a singing lesson in this style with Terry Riley from himself, a minimalist school of composition and influenced by jazz and classical. But you've got amazing orchestral arrangements. You know, you've got chamber pop, orchestral pop, arpeggiating pianos, you've got feedback and distortion. The level of producing skills in this is amazing. Sorry, okay.
I think people just have to listen to a track. Now, I must give a warning before we play this first track. There is some bad language from the very beginning. This is Ice Cream Piano.
Fuck the world.
Yes, Sinead, that was Ice Cream Piano by Vampire Weekend. There is a very big change there 1 minute in, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. From the get-go, they initially trick you into thinking that the band have taken on a subtle more different or subtle kind of trajectory with slight, soft, distorted background guitar, the slow-paced vocals. But as you hear, yeah, a minute and a half in, after that, they kick into the full, typical, distinctive Vampire Weekend force with the fast-paced guitars, the piano, the distinctive drums, the strings with violin and cello, adding to that frenetic sound with added violin staccato for added effect. It's just a brilliant opener to a great album.
It's interesting, when this band first emerged, they were accused by some of being too clever, believe it or not. You know, which, imagine accusing an artist of being too smart.
Was this musically or lyrically?
Everything. Just that, you know, and he is a hyper literate lyricist as well, Koenig. But in terms of the music, because there was a lot of Afro beats going on in the early albums, and you know, there was this snarky kind of feel that, oh, they're a bit too smart for their own good. I never bought that. I just thought this is a band that have always tried to do things differently. Like, they emerged from a New York scene that was quite indie oriented, and they wanted to do something different. And it's really great on a fifth album where they're still trying to do things really differently than before. Sinead mentioned Indian Raga. I mean, that's something that's comparatively new to their set. There's probably less of the Afrobeat than there was before, but it's a band in evolution. I think it's a really good thing.
And stars out of five from you, John, for Only God Was
It Is. It is another four with the potential to be a five when I live with this longer.
Oh, you had a good week listening. What about you, Sinead?
Yeah, just going to up it a little bit of a notch, 4.5.
4.5. Yeah. 2 4.5s from you. You came in very generous today. Then lastly, we have Corungabin. The band will play the Three Arena in Dublin next November. Tell us a little about them. Are they all instrumental, or is there variation on this album? In the past, they have been instrumental.
They have been very instrumental. They are quite an interesting bunch, and that's what they play on, I guess. So when they started the band, they started to focus on that one particular kind of style of genres and the instrumentation, and instead of thinking outside the box, they decided to remain within the box and truly explore those genres they submerge themselves in. So mainly instrumentally, yeah, they take you on a musical vacation through the world of psychedelic rock, soft jazz, surf rock, Thai funk, American roots, touch of disco, whilst taking in different influential and inspiration from rhythms and melodies from the likes of the Middle East, Persia and West Africa. But yeah, it is mainly instrumental. They do add in field recordings, some dubby beats, dialing back on the vocals and just merely utilising vocals as another layer to add to their instrumental melodies by way of whisperings and like this fluttering delivery. And it reminds me a little bit about ASMR, that autonomous sensory meridian response, which has become really big lately. It's a popular effective tool for assisting people in sleep enhancement and relaxation. So
the kind of Cillian Murphy get you to sleep vibe. Yes.
Yes. Whilst kind of tapping your fingernails on a glass and whispering, like Kelly Murphy. So it's a little bit like that. It's so like on the track 3, A to Jean, it's like a mixture of the ASMR with Je t'aime non mon plus.
All right.
From
okay.
Serge Gainsbourg.
Again, Sinead, you send us hitting the button to play. This is May 9th, and I think there is some whispering on this.
Nice.
John, that's not just whispering, that's full on vocals.
Yeah, well, Lizzie, who is a style icon, I mean, the bassist, she never wears the same outfit twice on stage. Her vocals are there almost as another instrument, though, rather than foregrounded. I mean, one of the things that the people dismiss this band as is, oh, they're great for easy listening or background music. And
Going to sleep music.
Yeah, and they're, you know, one might say, yeah, they make really good background music. But when you delve into this, there's so much happening. There's a great deal of texture, and there has been throughout their musical past. It's quite remarkable, actually, that they have attained a following big enough for them to play our largest indoor arena. But this is another fine album. It's probably the most chilled out album they've made to date. The title A La Sala, for those who are not up with their Spanish, as I'm not, is In the Room. And it is quite intimate, and it's a lovely album.
Stars out of 5 from you, John?
I'm going to be such a bore and say 4 again.
In
all my years reviewing albums in Arena, I've never listened to 3 really good albums. There's always been a bit of a miserable thing thrown in there, but these have all been very good and people should listen to them. It's been a great week.
What about you, Sinead? Misery or did you enjoy?
Oh, no, misery, absolutely not. It's a stunning, simmering, addictive example of this psychedelic rock shimmery genius. It's hard to put it into, you know, you're going to give me, I'll give it a four.
Give it a 4, okay. It's missed a 0.5 from you on that. So that was A La Sala, A Krungabin. And Vampire Weekend's album is Only God Was Above Us. And The Black Keys is Ohio Players. My thanks to Sinead Nivorda and John Marr. That's the programme for tonight and for the week. The programme was researched by Niall Fitzmaurice and Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. James Feeney was on sound. Dave Phelan was broadcast coordinator, and tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby.